A summer holiday in Greece or Italy sounds glorious, but not this year.
Never been so glad to get home from a holiday. It was nice to get back, to be honest.
Deadly heat and wildfires are making many rethink summer plans of the Mediterranean. Also today, a pilot summer school program for the children of migrant farm workers, with teachers from the U.S. and Mexico, and classes that reflect those points of view.
I think a lot of times students don't like history because they don't see themselves reflected in the history, and so I think what we're doing here is really, really making a difference.
I'm Marco Werman. Plus, a positive role for AI. It's very good at detecting breast cancer. This professor says radiologists need not worry about job security,
because they will be able to focus on the cases where we know that women are at higher risk of having cancer.
All that and more today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thanks for joining us today. This summer has seen record-shattering temperatures across the globe. July is set to be the hottest month in at least 120,000 years on Earth. Greece has been hit really hard by extreme heat waves. Last month, thousands of tourists had to flee wildfires on the island of Rhodes. The Greek government is offering them an all-expense-paid return trip for next year, but the long-term prognosis for getting visitors back looks bleak. A new report from the European Commission suggests that the days of carefree holidays on the Mediterranean may be numbered. Our Europe correspondent Orla Barry has our report.
Every year, Greek tourism releases publicity videos that sound something like this.
Enjoy the Greece you know. Discover the Greece you don't. Enter the heavenly Mediterranean, where islands are similar to each other for the crystal sapphire water lapping their beautiful beaches.
But the videos that went viral on Rhodes last month painted a very different picture.
So we're all being evacuated. The colour of everything has gone really weird. Everything's really orange.
Because of the smoke.
British holidaymakers like Blair Finder made TikTok videos as they fled their hotels in swimsuits and flip-flops. This video, taken by tourist Paul Watson, shows families huddled together on a small military boat in the dead of night somewhere off the island of Rhodes. Watson, who's from Cumbria in the north of England, was on a two-week holiday with his wife and two sons.
Supposed to be a special holiday, and it was in many ways.
He's talking to me over the phone from rainy Cumbria. It was the 10th night of their holiday in Janadi in Rhodes that the family were told to get out of their hotel room fast. They grabbed some belongings and walked to a nearby beach. It was already packed with other evacuated tourists, and it was the middle of the night. Watson says it was at this point he really did start to panic.
There were thousands of people on a beach, and you think about what it's like getting out of a rock concert or whatever. Crowds don't move quickly, but smoke does. And you started to think, oh, Christ, if the smoke really catches and comes towards us fast here, we haven't got very many options.
The Watsons were taken by boat to another part of the island and a few days later repatriated back home to England. The Greek government is hoping that the experience of the Watson family and thousands of others won't turn tourists off coming back to the island. Here's the country's Prime Minister, Kyriakos Mitsotakis, speaking on British television yesterday.
The island is perfectly back to normal. We have no active wildfires as we speak, and the weather for the next 15 days looks relatively benign.
Wildfires, Mitsotakis said, have been going on in Greece for millennia. Sustainable travel expert Elke Den says most people don't actually even think about potential wildfires when planning a summer holiday.
A study of the European Travel Commission measured that only 7% of the people today takes into account the possibility of extreme weather conditions when they decide where to go.
But Dens is hoping that this year's extreme weather in Greece will be a wake-up call for tourists. A new EU report also predicts that the holiday habits of Northern Europeans may be about to change. David Garcia León is the author of the study. He found that if summer temperatures go up by an additional 3 or 4 degrees, tourist numbers heading to places like the Greek islands could plummet by close to 10%. I ask him what he makes of surveys that show tourists just don't seem to think about the potential dangers of hot weather when planning a trip abroad.
The survey was conducted before all these extreme events took place. So perhaps the attitudes and preferences of tourists now are, I wouldn't say radically, but slightly different.
Garcia León also predicts that places like Wales and other cooler parts of Northern Europe could see a boost in tourist numbers. But Alkidens with the Travel Foundation says changing public habits is just not that easy. And governments, she says, have to be on board.
For some sustainable choices, you really need to have a legal framework. Just like, you know, the plastic bag discussion, it helps when it's just forbidden.
Yesterday, the Greek Prime Minister offered free holidays to all the tourists evacuated from Rhodes in July. Paul Watson in Cumbria says he doesn't rule out the idea of going back to Greece, but he says it wouldn't just be for a sun holiday.
To think that a fire that could have happened on any of the hot rocks in the Mediterranean, it just so happened to be Rhodes, to think that that could negatively impact the economy and therefore the people that looked after us so well, that would almost be my primary reason for revisiting.
Watson says it's been bucketing down with rain ever since they got back home to England. But he says he's never appreciated British weather quite so much. For The World, I'm Orla Barry.
Pope Francis is in Portugal this week. He's there for World Youth Day, which is sometimes referred to as Catholic Woodstock. His visit coincides as Portugal's Catholic Church is reckoning with its own role in the clergy sexual abuse scandal. Pope Francis did not shy away from it. He met with sex abuse survivors behind closed doors on the first day of his trip. Elise Ann Allen is senior correspondent for the Crux News website, which focuses on the Vatican and the Catholic Church. She's in Lisbon following the Pope. Elise, the official reason for Pope Francis's visit to Portugal is World Youth Day. What is it exactly?
It's basically where an event where young people from all over the world come together in a major city and they have a great time. World Youth Day is characterized for its enthusiastic, joyful, vibrant crowds and for young people just sort of charging through the streets, being loud, singing songs. It's really an event that's designed to help them grow in their faith and to provide a moment for them to share in that faith with other people their age. Especially at a time when, you know, secularism is growing and many of them might feel they're alone in their faith journey. And so it's really an opportunity for them to come together and see that that's not the case.
At the same time, Pope Francis has met with Portuguese victims of the clergy sexual abuse scandal. The findings of the investigation into that released just in February. Tell us about that meeting. What do we know?
Well, we don't know much, honestly. We knew that this meeting was going to happen, but they kept the details of it in terms of who attended and when it happened and where it happened. They did not publish those details in order to protect the privacy of the individuals who participated. The Vatican did say that the Pope met with around 13 victims of clerical sexual abuse, and that it was a time of sharing and reflection. And the Pope, as we've heard in bits and pieces, you know, that he apologized again to the victims. The statement that we got from the Vatican said that he spent a good amount of time just listening to them and to their stories, and he apologized and he wanted to just express his closeness to them for the suffering, the immense suffering that they've each endured.
I mean, the scandal is still pretty fresh. As I said, the details of the report released just in February. What are the details?
An independent commission last year had looked into the church's handling of clerical sexual abuse and potential cover-up on the part of the church. What they found was around 5,000 victims going back decades, and the commission that conducted the report said that's likely just the tip of the iceberg. And they found, like, the abusers, where they were not just priests, right, but also members of religious congregations and other church representatives, catechists, teachers in Catholic schools. And it's still, as you mentioned, very fresh. And the Pope acknowledged that in some of his speeches. In a speech to the bishops last night, he mentioned that there's anger and even hostility towards the church at times. You know, he flew in from Rome. He had a very busy schedule. And the fact that he chose to meet with them that night shows just how much he is aware of the impact those scandals have had and how much of a priority it is for him to make reparations.
Even before the report came out in February, Portugal had been dealing with severely declining church attendance, more people entering secularism, as you said, Elise. Has the Pope talked about that on this visit?
You know, he has. In his meeting with bishops and also his first meeting with young people, too, he mentioned that those who choose to go to church might also feel discouraged because none of their peers are doing it. And it's not an easy one. But he said something the church has to learn how to deal with. And it has to do that without losing its enthusiasm for sharing what he calls the joy of the gospel.
What about the Catholic Church's challenge to make itself more relevant and appealing to younger Catholics? I see that Francis met with university students and urged them to work toward a better future. I mean, generally, what do Portuguese youth hear when offered words of positive encouragement while the church is embroiled in this sex abuse scandal?
you know, his big message, especially in his first speech to them tonight, was, you know, inclusion. He really wanted to drive home that message of inclusion and welcome, that the church is a place that is welcoming towards everyone, no matter who they are, no matter what their background is. And he said, we have to be a place where people come and feel welcomed and they feel included. And if we see that they're not being welcomed or included, we need to change that. So I think for him, being relevant means increasingly being a place where people, you know, whoever they are, wherever they come from, can feel at home.
Elise Ann Allen is senior correspondent for the Crux News website. She's been speaking to us from Lisbon, where the Pope is visiting for World Youth Day. Elise, thank you very much.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Amid all the fears and hand-wringing over artificial intelligence, here's something, at least on the face of it, that's pretty encouraging. Early results from a study in Sweden show that AI is able to accurately detect 20% more breast cancers from mammograms than actual radiologists. The trial, which is still ongoing, looked at over 80,000 women. Aldana Rosso is one of the authors of the report about the new study, which appears in the journal Lancet Oncology. She's an associate professor of medical statistics at Lund University in Sweden. Just to be clear, Aldana, the actual mammograms were done in the usual way, but AI was used to read them, correct?
Yes, partially. What we have done is that we have two treatment arms. One is the regular reading with radiologists, and the other one is human radiologists together with artificial intelligence software. So it's an aid to the human radiology. The software was never reading on its own.
What is AI actually doing when it's reading a mammogram?
It's like a computer software, like any other software. And what it's doing is that it will compare the X-ray that you are showing to the software with a database with a lot of X-rays from other women with and without cancer. And then the AI software will give you a score, how likely is that that particular woman has cancer, and then it will be a score between 1 and 10. The software is just to give you a risk score.
And I'm guessing the AI is comparing the individual mammogram to a very large data set of other mammograms, right?
Yes, exactly. The current data set is about 200,000 mammograms, if I recall correctly.
Right. So that's a job that several radiologists would take a lot of time to do, correct?
Yeah, it would be impossible. We have a human radiologist. The only difference is that now this human has help from the computer and knows, well, this is a high-risk mammogram, so I need to look more careful. Or this is a very high-risk mammogram, so we have decided to actually do a new examination. Or if it's a low-risk mammogram, I just have a look, and then I move on to the next patient.
A really powerful tool. Did the AI-evaluated mammograms result in any false positives?
Yes, there have been women where the software had said, look, this feature looks suspicious, but the radiologist, the human radiologist, said, no, it's not. So in essence, a false positive is actually when you say that the woman is cancer-free and then she actually developed cancer before the next screening trial. But we haven't gone that far. But we have so far, I think, about 50 in the study so far. There are very few.
So AI is reducing the time spent by radiologists examining mammograms. We're also seeing headlines like AI can do the job of two radiologists. So what are the concerns for radiologists when it comes to this kind of assistance that might push them out of a job?
Our radiologists will always have a job. They will even have a better job, we believe, because they will be able to focus on the cases where we know that women are at higher risk of having cancer. So they will have more time for the women that actually need that time. And they will only use very little time for the women that, like most of the women in the screening program, do not have cancer.
Aldana Rosso is an associate professor of medical statistics at Lund University in Sweden and one of the authors of a new report on the use of AI to read mammograms, which appears in the journal Lancet Oncology. Thank you very much, Aldana.
Okay, thank you.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. There's a new record holder for the most massive animal ever discovered on Earth, the Perusetus colossus. That's Latin for the colossal whale from Peru. Perusetus was found to be heavier than the heaviest living animal, the blue whale, by a lot. The discovery of its fossils was published yesterday in the journal Nature. Alberto Coloretta from the University of Pisa is one of the paleontologists on the team that dug up this beast of a whale. Alberto, tell us first, how big is big?
It's like about 180 tons big. That is well in the range of extant adult blue whales or even above it.
So you're saying the tonnage is even greater than the blue whale, which is currently the heaviest animal?
Yeah, it could be. It could be. It's certainly in the range or even above it.
Well, I saw reports that each vertebra of a Parasitas weighs over 220 pounds. Each rib measures some 5 feet long. So while it's not official, based on what you've already seen, you're certain it'll be heavier than the blue whale.
Yeah, we were able to produce this range of body sizes. It's quite broad, from a bit more than 80 tons to as many as 340 tons. But we have been conservative, and so we are quite confident that this range is really reliable in some way.
Alberto, take us to the place in Peru where you discovered these fossils. What did you see as you started to unearth them?
The fossil was discovered 13 years ago by Mario Urbina, associate researcher at the Natural History Museum of San Marcos University in Lima. And when I first went to Lima, what I can tell you is what I felt when I first saw some of the bones, namely some vertebrae, in the paleontological lab of the Natural History Museum in Lima. I told to myself, that's amazing, that's crazy, and maybe that's just a joke, and what if the skeleton has been manufactured? Of course, that was not the case, and we really were in front of an animal unlike any other, or at least any other I had seen before.
And what did when you saw those 220-pound vertebrae, what did they tell you?
If you inflate bones of other basilosaurids, some of which are found in the same strata, in the same desert, you get the idea of how bones of Perusetus are swollen versions of normal archaic cetacean bones.
And cetaceans, that's the general word for whales and species of whales, yeah?
Yeah.
Well, we've seen artists' renderings of what Parasitas might have looked like, a long balloon-shaped animal with a flat back flipper and tiny arms, and notably for its size, a pretty small head. Is that how you imagined it looked?
Yeah, it could be. It should be, based on what we know of the skeleton. What we still miss and would like to find out, I would be so glad to find out, would be the skull. Finding out the skull would also mean to understand way more about the ecology and diet of this incredibly bizarre animal.
Alberto Coloretta is a paleontologist from the University of Pisa, speaking with us about the beast that he's been researching, Parasitas colossus. Alberto, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your kind invitation.
A quick warning that this next story is not suitable for all listeners. Amnesty International has released one of the first human rights reports looking at the conflict in Sudan, which began in mid-April. Fighting between the Sudanese army and a paramilitary group called the Rapid Support Forces has killed and injured thousands of people. Violence against women and girls has been especially bad. The World's Africa correspondent Halima Gikandi has our story.
The new report by Amnesty lays bare what Sudanese have been saying for months, that as the army and RSF fight for power, it's they who bear the cost of war. Abdullahi Hassan is one of Amnesty's researchers behind today's report.
The direct attacks on civilians, the attacks on humanitarian facilities, rape and other forms of sexual violence against women and girls in the context of the conflict, and the pillage amount to war crimes.
In many conflicts, women and girls are most vulnerable. It's no different in Sudan.
All the parties to the conflict, and particularly the RSF and allied Arab militia, are committing sexual violence, including rape, in many parts of the country, in Khartoum, in West Darfur, in other parts of Darfur.
The cases documented in this report are harrowing. Groups of women being kidnapped and detained for days as they are raped. In other cases, fighters go directly into the safety of women's homes and violate them in front of their families.
One father of two ladies, two young girls who were raped in Khartoum, told us how they came to his home and raped his girls.
It's difficult to get a full picture of the scope of sexual violence in this war, but Suleyma Ishaq Al-Khalifa says it's underreported. She's the director of the Combating Violence Against Women Office in the Sudanese government. It's been collecting information on violence against women throughout this conflict.
What we see is targeting of young women from the age of 12, young girls, not only women, from the age of 12 to the age of 16, 17. And sometimes targeting particular African ethnical groups.
She tells me the problem is worse for women in Darfur, where the conflict has taken on an ethnic dimension. Ishaq estimates 90% of the perpetrators of sexual violence in this conflict are the RSF militia. She thinks part of the motivation is humiliation.
There is ethnical humiliation and sometimes just mere humiliation for all people, like humiliation for the people remaining in their houses, for the people remaining to stand up, guarding their things.
In this way, she says the war that started between rival generals has become a war against civilians. There are also reports of women who have gone missing in recent months.
A lot of numbers of disappearance of women missing. So they just disappeared when they just get out to do something from the store or to bring medications.
Pictures of these missing young women are circulating on social media platforms with contact numbers for their families. What is happening to these women? Khalifa asks. There needs to be accountability, she says. Sarah Jackson with Amnesty agrees. She says the years of lack of accountability for crimes against civilians in Sudan has emboldened the armed actors.
It's precisely because people have not been held to account in the past that they think they can get away with this again. So accountability has to be central to any kind of resolution of this current situation.
As international attempts at mediation continue, justice should be on the table, Jackson says.
And those families of victims and survivors have every right to justice, to truth, to reparations in a new Sudan.
The RSF has said that they reject abuses against civilians during this war. Right now, however, the goal is evidence collection and preservation. For the world, I'm Halima Gikandi in Nairobi.
More news and stories from around the globe still ahead this hour. You're listening to The World. Ukraine is now littered with dangerous landmines. Unexploded ordnance is still a problem that Belgium has been dealing with for more than a century. They're still found in farm fields every day.
By the sight alone, we know what it is. It's a German one, high explosive shell. It's still possible to explode.
The lasting consequences of war still ahead on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. In Colombia, a six-month ceasefire began today between the nation's military and the country's largest remaining rebel group, the National Liberation Army, or ELN.
Cuando una sociedad tiene esperanza, cambia.
Colombian President Gustavo Petro said today, when a society has hope, it changes. The new truce of 6 months marks the longest one ever between the two sides, but divisions remain over whether it's the best way to approach a group that's known for its attacks on civilians. From Bogota, Manuel Rueda has our story.
Nelson Leal is the mayor of Tibú, a town of about 60,000 people near Colombia's border with Venezuela. He fled the town in March when he faced death threats from the ELN and other groups that have been vying for control of the area's drug trafficking routes. So Leal now does his job from Cúcuta, a larger and safer city that's about 4 hours away. He takes calls and meets with members of his administration at a small office that was lent to him by the local governor. I'm not the only one who's absent from Tibú, he says. There's no prosecutor there or any courts. We have no human rights ombudsman or border officials. Leal is hoping that the ceasefire between the Colombian government and the ELN rebels will make it possible for him to return home, and for more government agencies to work in his town to tackle problems like poverty and crime. Under the ceasefire that begins today, Colombia's military and the ELN have said that they will stop attacking each other. The ceasefire agreement also says they will cease attacks on civilians. Hopefully, they'll stick to what they agreed to, Leal says. The ceasefire is part of President Gustavo Petro's plans to pacify parts of Colombia that continue to be affected by armed groups that didn't join a 2016 peace deal with the government. One of them is the ELN, which has around 2,500 troops and is especially influential along Colombia's border with Venezuela. The group has been around since the 1960s and was founded by students and union leaders inspired by the Cuban Revolution. Nowadays, it makes a lot of its money from the drug trade and from taxing legal businesses. President Petro, who was once a member of a rebel group himself, says that the truce is an opportunity to build trust with the ELN and provide some relief to areas of the country affected by violence. During a recent visit to Arauca, another region affected by fighting, Petro was greeted warmly by locals who swarmed around the president to shake his hand and get his autograph. Speaking to the crowd, he urged the ELN rebels to lay down their weapons.
Dejar el fusil, dejar el poder del arma, es lo más revolucionario y democrático que se puede hacer.
Leaving your machine guns behind is the most revolutionary step you can take, he says. You need to give the people the chance to decide their own destiny and create their own history. But some fear that the ceasefire will only make the rebels stronger. In the past, other rebel groups have taken advantages of truces with the military to increase their drug traffic and profits and buy more weapons. Then, they've gone back to war when they weren't satisfied with what was being offered to them at peace talks. Last month, thousands of people turned up at a rally in Bogotá to protest against President Petro's security policies, including the ceasefire. Guillermo Rojas is a retired police officer. Everyone wants peace, he says, but you can't give a criminal group so many advantages at the start of talks. The government is throwing away its leverage. Elizabeth Dickinson is a Colombia expert at the International Crisis Group. She says that the only way to increase support for the talks is if the ELN's attacks against civilians decrease during the truce.
There is limited patience for negotiations with this organization, particularly while insecurity continues to increase. And if there are incidents that are high profile, whether it's recruitment, whether it's kidnapping, whether it's businessmen denouncing that there's ongoing extortion, that can easily discredit the talks in ways that are very much separate from the negotiating table, but limit the government's capability to keep sitting at the table if there aren't real results.
For the moment, both sides have agreed to create committees where local groups like farmers' associations or trade organizations can provide their views on how to fix problems like poverty or the drug trade. The ELN says that it wants to use the recommendations that emerge from those meetings to spell out its demands to the Colombian government. So, while the truce might bring some relief to areas affected by violence, it looks like the peace talks are just getting started. For The World, I'm Manuel Rueda, Bogota.
Ukraine has been saddled with an unfortunate distinction. It's now believed to have more landmines than any country in the world. Nearly 1,000 civilians have been killed or injured by mines and unexploded ordnance since early 2022. About a third of the country now needs to be cleared of explosives. Most of that land borders Russia, but it also includes parts of the Kyiv region in Ukraine's interior. As part of our series this week looking at the environment and the war in Ukraine, The World's Carolyn Beeler visited a farm there to see what people in this part of the country are dealing with.
Yuri Zaharui is driving me around part of the 15,000-acre farm he helps manage. They raise dairy cows, grain, and staple crops like soy and potatoes. We're north of Kyiv in an area Russian forces reached in their failed push for the capital.
He said that Russians...
We're speaking through an interpreter.
When Russians occupied this village, they entered this village on February 27th. So basically day three of the war.
The farm's security cameras caught tanks rolling over their land.
This house was completely destroyed.
We get out of the car and Zaharui tells me to stay close. The overgrown field in front of us hasn't been demined.
Але на цьому полі з цього боку і з того було знайдено 11 протитанкових мін.
Last spring, we found around 10 anti-tank mines here, and one local resident got injured when one of the mines blew up.
It's a gorgeous late spring evening. The leaves on the trees in front of us are rustling in the wind. There are these small yellow flowers in the overgrown field that are practically glowing in the setting sun. It's hard to imagine mines nestled near their roots, but they're probably there.
Can you take me back to the beginning of the full-scale invasion? What happened here?
Сюди зайшли російські війська, і ось тут була зона зона розмежування. Вони не йшли далі, бо тут були.
Where we're standing right now was sort of a gray zone because Ukrainian military was positioned over there behind the forest, 500 feet away from here, and over there there is a highway leading towards Kyiv.
Russian forces were trying to reach that highway.
But Ukrainian forces stopped them here, so they were simply fighting in this area.
So your farm was caught right in the middle?
Yeah, the farm was caught in the middle.
Because of the fighting, about 20% of their fields couldn't be planted or harvested last year. That's about the same as the nationwide average for 2022, in a country where agriculture is a major economic driver. This farm is a big employer in the area and has had to lay off workers. About 10% of their fields are still off limits because of mines.
So it's 1,500 acres that are still mined?
1,500 acres are still mined.
So what have you heard about how long it's going to take to demine all of that?
Zaharui explains that two different companies are already clearing his fields. Some of it is being done with a remotely operated demining machine that looks like a big tractor. He estimates it'll take anywhere from a year to a decade to finish the job.
Небезпека тут повсюди, слухайте, тут навіть не на полі, тут міни можуть бути тут в посаці для грибників якихось.
The dangers are not only here in the field. For example, over there in this small forest, there can be unexploded munition over there. And, you know, if someone goes mushroom picking, they can get hurt.
Forests in the Kyiv region and elsewhere are closed because of the risk. The World Bank estimates demining work would cost nearly $38 billion over the next decade. With Ukraine's current demining capacity, however, some experts think it will take more than 700 years to clean up the country.
У нас регіон, який був в окупації місяць, що буде на сході країни, що буде.
Of course we are concerned because look, this village was under occupation for a month and look what we have right now. So imagine what is going to happen in the east of Ukraine or other parts of Ukraine. This is the problem that will haunt us for decades.
That was farmer Yuri Zaharui speaking with the world's Carolyn Beeler, who's with me now. Carolyn, 700 years to clean up Ukraine's mines. That really speaks to the long tail of war. It makes me think of all the conflicts where mines have been deployed. So let's widen the lens here. Where else are mines a problem?
Lots of places. Several thousand people a year are killed or injured by landmines. That's from more recent conflicts like in Yemen and also decades-old wars like in Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos. And mines are only part of the problem. Unexploded ordnance like bombs, grenades, shells that didn't blow up when they originally fired, those are also deadly.
Carolyn, people are still dealing with these from World War I and World War II, right? I mean, we hear those occasional stories about like that construction crew in Berlin finding an unexploded bomb there.
That's right. In Belgium, for example, the area around the town of Ypres in Flanders became a moonscape from all the shells that were fired there in World War I. And even today, people are constantly encountering unexploded ordnance. Farmers, as they're out working in their fields, they even have a name for it, the Iron Harvest. Sander Polmans is a member of Belgium's bomb disposal unit that gets called when anyone finds one of these things.
Normally, we have 2 to 3 cases every year where a farmer hits a shell with his farming equipment and the shell blows up. So the farmers are sometimes hurt.
One of our producers went out the other day with Polmans and his team responding to a call after a farmer found a shell during the potato harvest.
By the sight alone, we know what it is. It's a German one, a German 15 centimeters, high explosive shell. It's still possible to explode.
He says about a third of the explosive ammunition fired during World War I didn't go off.
Wow, and that stuff is just buried in farm fields now, scattered all around the Flemish countryside?
Yeah, Paul Munz and his team say they're responding to calls like this all day, every day.
Normally, we can go to 20, 30 places a day when it's in autumn and when all the farmers start harvesting. We have a lot of places to visit.
He says hand grenades are about the same size as potatoes, so they often get picked up by the harvesters.
I mean, it is a grim irony that. How does it actually work when they remove grenades from a field?
Well, Polmans and his team will take a hammer and a brush to chip away the decades of rust and dirt that have accumulated. It's important for them to see, one, if the shell was ever fired, whether it's still explosive, or if it includes a chemical agent. Then after they ID it, they take it back to their barracks, where they'll inspect it more and then eventually safely detonate it.
Now, Carolyn, you also spoke with another member of the unit, Jacques Calabot, when he was back at the barracks to understand more about how this unexploded ordnance affects people's lives.
Yeah, he's a veteran member of the team. He's also worked in places like Afghanistan. And here's where I started our conversation. I knew that in France, after World War I, the government closed access to former battlefields that were just too covered in unexploded ordnance. They thought it would just be too hard to clean up. So now nobody can live there. Access is limited. So I asked Jacques Calabot why Belgium took a different approach.
No, it's not at all off limits. We didn't make that choice about a century ago. So the land is free for the farmers again. Belgium is much smaller than France was. We do not have that much surface, so we needed everything which we could have. So therefore, our government decided that this was the policy of dealing with the ammunition.
So is all the land being farmed and people just encounter munitions when they encounter them?
That's it. That's basically the idea of how we deal with the problem. A century ago, they left the farmland again to the farmers, so they started to put the agriculture on it. And if they found something, we will help them out.
And so what happens when people get injured? They're farming the land and then they encounter something and it explodes?
That can happen, yeah. But most of the time, luckily enough, it's underneath their plow. So they're a little bit protected about their tractor and about their plow.
I gather in Belgium, where you are, you're removing a lot more unexploded bombs, grenades, missiles, things like that. Not so much mines. Why is that?
For more than one reason. One reason is that the mined areas were the first to deal with, and those were marked. After the Second World War and after the First War also, the first thing we dealt with was the mined areas. And the second reason is that mining is a small part of the unexploded ammunition problem. Mines is not even 10% in general of the contaminated area. So it's a lesser problem than the other shells and grenades which are lying around.
So are they as likely to explode as they were 100 years ago, or have they deteriorated in some way and they're less likely to?
Not really. The only thing which happens is that there is rust, and instead of just making it safer, the rust makes them more dangerous than they used to be. The explosive filling is still explosive. If we let it detonate, it'll detonate. And the fuses which are stuck on it are still as lethal as they used to be.
What about more modern munitions, ones being used in conflicts today? Do we know what kind of risks those are going to pose in 100 years, say? Or do you think they're going to be just as dangerous or more dangerous than those from earlier wars?
It'll be the same. In fact, the principles of ammunition didn't change. The filling changed, the power of explosives changed, effectiveness of fuses changed, but in fact, the principles are the same. If you touch or manipulate an ammunition which was intent to kill somebody, well, you take a risk of being killed yourself.
How long is it going to take for you to remove all these World War I and II bombs from Belgium?
I have to give you a question mark. I don't know. After the First World War, they thought it would be over by 2025. We're still dealing with it. So that's how much ordnance can be found after a world war. By the way, in Cambodia and Laos and Vietnam, they're also still dealing with ammunition which was found. The same with Afghanistan. It's a whole territory. And you cannot just, on an organized way, just look for the ammunition. That's too difficult.
That was Jacques Calabot with Belgium's Bomb Disposal Unit, speaking with the world's Carolyn Beeler from outside Ypres, Belgium. The segment was produced by Josh Coe. Tomorrow on the show, a look at Ukraine's Hero River and new wetlands that may be there to stay. Yesterday, we shared with you the tale of a stairwell that leads to nowhere. Today, an ironic birthday party for a bridge that connects nothing to nothing. Residents of Warsaw, Poland celebrated the 10th anniversary of a highway overpass that has no on-ramp, no off-ramp. An aerial photo shows a smart-looking highway bridge above four railway tracks, but at each end the concrete turns to grass. No road on either side. The $1.2 million bridge was built a decade ago to connect a district of Warsaw with a neighboring town, but they can't agree on how to finish the project, and not a single car has driven across the bridge. Broken glass bottles hint at how it's actually been used. The news site Notes from Poland says it's mostly a place to party. The children of migrant farm workers often go on the move with their parents. Following the picking season means interrupting the school calendar. Now a summer program intended to give students a little extra educational help is bringing together teachers from Southern California and Mexico. Lance Orozco of station KCLU visited a school where elementary students are getting a true international education.
I need you to tell me where are the three countries that are near Mexico.
I know. We're in a classroom in the Ventura County community of Somas where dozens of kids are taking part in a one-of-a-kind summer education program. Students are being quizzed on geography. They're being asked to name countries near Mexico.
Americans.
United States? Yeah.
Guatemala.
Belize. Very good.
It's a month-long program being hosted by the Somas Union School District in the Ventura County Office of Education, aimed at helping the children of migrant farm workers. Two teachers from Mexico are here, team teaching with four Ventura County teachers.
The binational program is a collaboration between the United States and Mexico. Teachers have the opportunity to come stay with our kiddos for 3 weeks. The intent here is for them to deliver instruction to migrant students.
Dr. Jesus Vaca is the superintendent principal of Somas School.
It's a opportunity for kids to be in a comfort zone so that they can gain confidence to be able to now then integrate as they go back to the school. Class sizes are very small and very effective. It's a nurturing environment that will allow these students to definitely grow their confidence.
It's the first time the program has been offered in Ventura County. In fact, it's only been done in three places in the state. Educators say the program is important because it gives a boost to some students who face the issue of having to move frequently because their parents follow the agricultural jobs.
Our migrant students travel sometimes from school district, state to state, and sometimes from country to country.
Cynthia Salas is a migrant education specialist with the Ventura County Office of Education.
The teachers work together throughout the day with our U.S. teachers. It's an opportunity for both the United States teachers and the Mexican teachers to learn from each other and work together, and at the same time circle around the student and provide any extra support needed to helping our migrant education students open up and feel more comfortable in the classroom.
8-year-old Isabel Garcia is one of the students in the program.
We do a lot of science. We can type. We read books. We did art. We played games.
The day is structured so the kids do academic subjects like language, computer skills, and math, as well as fun activities like art. The two visiting teachers offer cultural enrichment programs about Mexico.
My name is Luisa Aguilera. I'm from Mexico, Villahermosa, Tabasco.
She says it's exciting to be involved in such a unique program.
They are discovering new words. They are discovering new things that they didn't know, but they are really, really interested in. So we are so, grateful for this experience, and they are grateful too because they are doing some new things here.
While the month-long program is based at Somas School, the students are from a half dozen Ventura County school districts. Consuelo Hernandez-Williams is the Associate Superintendent of Student Services with the Ventura County Office of Education.
Grade level for the binational program is grades 2 through 6. They're grouped according to grade spans. 2 through 3, the 4 through 5, and then the 6. And then for the cultural piece, as well as the technology piece, the team did a really good job of engaging students in a diagnostic so that they could group students according to ability.
The American teachers involved in the program are also from around the county. Tito Rojas is a math teacher at Rio Vista Middle School in Oxnard.
Being a Mexican ancestry and a history major, I didn't really appreciate history until I started learning history about myself. And I think a lot of times students don't like history because they don't see themselves reflected in the history. And so I think what we're doing here is really, really making a difference.
The program has a special meaning for Edward Magana, who's a teacher in the Santa Paula Unified School District.
It's great. I grew up in the migrant program, so to have this program available to students, it's amazing. Every student could benefit from this program, but even more so are migrant students.
Students in the program, like Alonzo Laiz, say it makes learning fun.
Well, we basically learn more about our Mexico and our culture. I like the drawing part. It's just fun. I just like doing it.
While this is a pilot project, those involved in it are already calling it their first annual event. They say it's such an important boost for migrant students, they want to offer it every summer. For The World, I'm Lance Orozco in Ventura County, California.
As protests go, the one in Yorkshire, England today was quiet but visually dramatic. It went down at the private home of British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. Demonstrators for Greenpeace climbed to the roof of the large two-story country house, then shrouded the building in large black sheets from the eaves.
We're all here because Rishi Sunak has opened the door to a new drilling frenzy in the North Sea, while large parts of our world are literally on fire.
A Greenpeace protester identified as Alex Wilson was sitting on Sunak's roof and shot a video message of protesters also on the roof with a yellow sign that read, "No new oil."
It's not going to lower your energy bills. It's not going to boost our energy security. The only people that stand to profit anything from this are the big oil companies. So Rishi needs to pick a side. Oil profits or our future on a habitable planet.
Prime Minister Sunak announced on Monday that the UK will grant hundreds of new oil and gas drilling licenses in the North Sea, saying fossil fuels are critical to the UK's energy independence. Sunak's office released a statement after today's protest, saying it does not apologize for, quote, using the resources we have here at home so we are never reliant on aggressors like Putin for our energy. As for the protesters, many people questioned how they got onto the roof of the Prime Minister's home in the first place. A former deputy chief constable in North Yorkshire told LBC Radio he was absolutely astonished by the major breach of security. Six protesters in red jumpsuits and neon safety gear are seen in the photos and videos Greenpeace shared. Five of them were arrested. Leaving you today with this shot of optimism from Dominican musician Yasser Tejeda and his tune Todo Va a Marchar. It'll all work out. The Afro roots of his music are clear, sounds from Congo and Nigeria, a little compa from Haiti. We worry, he sings, but in the end, everything is going to be all right. Canta conmigo y verás. The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman. Thanks as always for listening.